Good evening and welcome. This is Psych One-on-One, and I'm Julianne Good. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for your family and your friends and yourself to make your lives easier. So happy holidays, everybody. I hope you're enjoying your lives out there. I hope everything went well for you this year and that you have some great goals ahead for yourself and your family for 2016. I think it's going to be a fantastic year. So tonight, my special in-studio guest is Dr. Tarik Grace. He is the program director of Elite Care in Costa Mesa, California. We are going to be talking about drug and alcohol addiction and some more information to weed out what is really happening with our country with addiction. It's sometimes scary, and I think there's a lot of fallacies and misfacts out there that we're going to try to weed through this evening. So, Dr. Grace, hi, how are you? Welcome.
Thank you. I'm doing well.
Great. Can you tell the listening audience a little bit about your background?
Sure. We'll start at the start, I suppose. I'm a medical doctor and formally trained as an anesthesiologist. Went through medical school and did my residency training, and then my life took an absolute radical turn. They're completely unplanned, and that was me getting involved with drugs. And I've spent the last 18 years of my life battling drug addiction right up until I finally get sober. And it was a very, very rocky road, as many, many people as many people have. And in getting sober, I saw a lot of different areas that I started to look at it kind of with both two sets of eyes. One is the patient going through this absolute devastation, and two, in an odd way, as a clinician, of seeing what was working, what wasn't working, evaluating myself, and evaluating others, and evaluating programs and modalities and methods. I had no idea that during all that time, that 18 years, that was probably doing a roundabout way of like an internship, for lack of a better term, in becoming to the role that I have now, which is directing a program for recovering alcohol and drug addicts. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. There's a lot to that. There's the ups and downs. There's the all arounds. There's going from the top and reaching some really celebrated highs from society standpoint, to also the bottoms and the deepest parts of the lows, and really everything in between. And it's given me, I don't know how much of a unique perspective, but it's certainly given me a perspective that hopefully I can shed some light for some people on some things.
Right, I agree. And the beautiful thing is that you've been on both sides. You're not one of those textbook physicians saying, this is bad for you because of A, B, C, and D, and just, you know, putting out the medical jargon and people don't understand. And they can't relate to you because they're like a lot of, you know, people who are addicted to substances look at somebody who hasn't had an addiction problem as a normie. And they have a lower level of trust. So I think because you have that insight, you've gone through your struggles and you've been successful amidst the addiction. I think that is very prevalent. You are to be admired. And, you know, I think it's awesome that you're here and you're talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's really interesting. You don't have to be a cancer survivor to treat somebody effectively that has cancer, or you know, suffer from hypertension or cardiac disease to effectively manage somebody with those symptoms. But for many reasons, there's the level of credibility with one addict addressing another is almost instant. And you combine the two with having the clinical and technical expertise per se, as well as the tangible, real gritty having been there. And for some reason, again, you know, most other ailments, you don't have to have suffered from it in order to treat it. But it seems that it's to be effective, you have to have both in this case.
I know. I mean, and that's amazing because it is a disease process. And it's so misunderstood. I mean, there's still the stigma that addicts are, you know, losers and they can't control themselves. And I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And it's like, I think people just still don't get the concept that anybody can end up having an addiction problem. Anybody at any time. And it just, it hits you out of nowhere. Like as you had stated at the beginning.
I can tell you that growing up, I grew up, you know, relatively normal upbringing, for lack of a better term, an upper middle class family. They were first generation from Egypt, and I was born in Seattle, and I grew up, and I, you know, I played sports, and I did well in school, and I didn't have any major issues, perhaps, you know, some overzealous parental goals and that I had to live up to or felt that I had to live up to, but who doesn't coming from an upper middle class family? I don't know if I can say that I was at the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time when I was susceptible to, you know, trying something. Mm-hmm. And it was an experiment. And I don't know how many viewers are here would actually say they've never experimented with anything. I think that people experiment.
Right.
And I had experiments before that were very benign. But this one time, it wasn't benign at all. It activated something in me that I had no clue was going to get activated. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know it existed.
What was the substance?
It was cocaine.
Okay.
It was cocaine. I was 24 years old before I'd ever done a hard drug in my life, which is a little unusual, I think, for especially with what we're seeing nowadays in drug addiction. Most people start in their early teens, but that wasn't my case. And I was instantly hooked, absolutely instantly. And it was, I didn't even understand it. I didn't understand why this is something that I couldn't stop thinking about. And all my life I had been in control prior to that, and was able to, you know, if I had to study for something or if I had to do reach some certain goal, I would muster up the will and be able to reach that goal. But for some reason, I could not muster up the will to stay away from this substance. And, you know, it completely overwhelmed my life. And I think that you brought up this thing, it's a disease, and it's a tough sell for a lot of people. It's a really tough sell. It's, you know, in 1957, I believe, American Medical Association, they classified alcoholism and addiction as an Axis I psychiatric disorder. And, you know, it stayed in the opinion of the American Medical Association and those who, and the diagnosticians, it has always remained in that place. Yet for a variety of reasons, nobody really looks at it like that. They look
still
at it still.
I know, it's incredible. I mean, the stigma has been so long lasting. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that keeps it? What keeps that into place?
Well, a variety of things. And most often it's looking at an addict in active use and not being able to understand the fact that they don't have a choice. Because you could say, well, listen, I can put a gun to your head and put your drug of choice in front of you, and you're not going to do it. So you're going to choose not to do it. Mm-hmm. And so that's, so people believe that choice is this, you don't choose to see how cancer reacts, for example, or a diabetic cannot control their blood sugar, but an alcoholic can control whether he drinks or not. And I guess that's the real question, is that society sees people and they scratch their heads, like, why doesn't he or she just stop?
Right. And how many family members are, they're asking that question every day. Why can't you stop? What makes you choose that substance over having a relationship with me? Because I see that so often, you know, and it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking for everybody that's involved in that situation. They're just, as I tell some of my clients, look at your substance of choice. And that can be anything, including chocolate or coffee or, I mean, we can be addicted so easily to so many things. And people just, you know, they just don't look at that. But it is a relationship substitute for many people. It's something is missing, you know. And it may not be the case when they get into it, but once they get deeper into it, a lot of people are choosing their drug over the relationships. It's hard.
I can definitely relate to everything you just said. I mean, I look at it near the end. I mean, I gave up everything, everything for it. I gave up my family. I gave up my profession. I gave up my earning capacity. I gave up my dignity. I gave up everything. And for an outsider looking in, I gave it away. I didn't have it taken from me. And I believe to this day, you know, I gave it away. I chose, and this is the argument here, is I chose drugs and alcohol over all of those things. But what I couldn't choose is I couldn't choose whether or not to crave drugs and alcohol. And I think that's really where a lot of the disease comes in, mm-hmm. this actual craving, because a drug addict cannot choose whether they crave or not. And the cravings can become so substantial that without ironclad ability, coping mechanisms, changes in perspective, support groups, structure, routine, connection, without those all in place, the cravings become overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And in order to get the craving to stop, you succumb to using. And it's the cycle that we see. I remember going through it myself. And so I speak this both from a textbook standpoint and also from a personal standpoint of I couldn't stop thinking about it. It was overwhelming, and I knew driving to go get this, that this was the dumbest idea I could ever come up with. Yet I knew also that I was going to give into it at some point. So I may as well give into it now.
I had a relatively same experience because I was a polysubstance abuser when I was in my teens. It was really bad between the ages of 12 and 17. And it was the same thing too. That's all I could think about was, where am I going to get my next fix? And it didn't make any difference what it was at a certain point. It didn't make any difference whether it was pills or pot or, you know, I mean, it was central Wisconsin, so there wasn't a whole lot available at that point, not like there is now. There is an alarming rate and variety of drugs out there now that people can get into, that I'm glad I didn't have that kind of access, because I was really almost betting with myself that I was going to be dead by the age of 20. I thought that was going to be it. But I knew that if I got out of there, I had a chance to survive. Which I did. I made two major moves because I had to get out of there. And it's, you know, that is a huge component nowadays that people are not taking into consideration. Also, is what is the neighborhood that you are in now? What is the drug and alcohol use there? Because if everyone is using or a large proportion is using, you're going to be using too because you want to fit in. Because if you don't, you know, you're going to be the outlier. You're going to be the, you know, why aren't you using with us, right? I mean, it's so difficult.
Well, you bring up a really important aspect. And I think this is, people don't really see this as being a connection between all diseases, but it really is a connection between all diseases. And there's a genetic predisposition to a disease. And that genetic predisposition is subject to environmental stimulus. So you have a certain genetic predisposition, and if subjected to the right environment, the combination of the two equals disease. And it really depends on the overlap there, which is kind of the range of the ability to have or to get the certain disease. So, for example, in your example you have, there are going to be people, there are absolutely people that strive, complete school, never get addicted, and grew up in inner cities where cocaine and heroin are abundant. Those numbers are small.
Right.
Because of the environmental stimulus is so profound. If you have any genetic predisposition, you're a goner. You're a goner. The same aspect, there's people that have a very, very small genetic or very large genetic predisposition. And I might fall into that category, that when subjected to a chemical once, just once, it activates the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, almost all diseases are like that. People that have genetic predispositions to lung cancer, for example, may never develop lung cancer unless they have the, you know, an environmental stimulus, cigarette smokes or different types of toxins that inhaled that triggers the disease. Now, I'm kind of dumbing it down in a lot of regards, but that's really what it boils down to, is those two factors.
Mm-hmm. It's important to look at your family history, basically. If one or both of your parents particularly are alcoholics, I mean, because that's really common. Now, wouldn't you say that alcoholism is still on the top of the run of addiction problems worldwide? Because it's so easily accessible, it's socially acceptable.
Well, that's absolutely, it goes right back to what we were just talking about. You have a open bar, for lack of a better term, of environmental stimulus. You know, walk down any street corner, go to any grocery store, go to any, and not only is it environment, is it available, but it's encouraged, it's advertised, mm-hmm. it's shiny bottles dressed up with pretty people doing elegant things and looking sophisticated. So it's socially pressured. So you have that combination of access. Sure, alcoholism is incredibly endemic, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. in the United States. And it's really interesting because alcoholism follows, in many aspects and respects, diabetes. And people don't, it's a really actually great example or metaphor to put up, because you have two types of diabetics. You have diabetics that are type 1, which is also known as juvenile onset diabetics, and they typically require insulin at an early age, 15, 16, 17 years old, in order, that's when the disease kind of prevails itself. And it's highly, highly, highly genetic in nature. It's not always passed down necessarily, but there's a genetic predisposition to it. Mm-hmm. So you have that type 1. Then you have type 2 diabetics. Type 2 diabetics have some genetic predisposition, but their lifestyle of overflowing or overdoing their body with too many carbohydrates over X amount of time basically tires the pancreas out. It gives up. And so you have this, one is genetically produced and the other one is environmentally produced.
Mm-hmm.
Disease, both of the same outcome, elevated blood sugar and difficulty maintaining normal levels. Alcoholism actually has type 1 and type 2 alcoholics as well. And you have the type 1 alcoholic, which is, again, early onset. Typically, we see it only in males, onset between 12 to 15 years old. And they really struggle with that. Most of them are incarcerated. Some are functional, but you know, they're ill, poorly understood by families, by society, et cetera. Often have violent pasts and violent violence associated with it. And, you know, it's clearly, from the first time they've drank, they've had an issue with it. And I think if we look back at our high school years, we can always think about that one or two or three or four people that was like that. And then you have the type 2 alcoholic, which is the type that over time, if bathed, for lack of a better term, in enough alcohol, an environment that they develop a dependence on alcohol. Mm-hmm. So it really does, you know, with open eyes, you can see how this follows disease models. Yet we still don't buy it. We still think this guy has got a choice.
Yeah, well, the information is only becoming available now. And I think because people are hopefully searching for the answers, because I think it's rare that a person does not know someone else if it's not their own selves that has an alcohol and or substance abuse problem, period. It's rampant.
They say that statistics will vary, but kind of the commonly accepted statistic is 1 in 10 people suffers from addiction. Mm-hmm. If you look at certain populations, impaired professionals, for lack of a better term, there's some statistics that are put out by the American Medical Association, says about 1 in 7 physicians. Interestingly, I like to always bring this up. The legal profession has an incredibly high endemic nature for alcoholism. Some statistics cite up to 25%.
Wow.
So you're right. When you think about that, the ripple effect, I don't think there's a person out there that hasn't had their lives affected in one way or another by addiction.
Right.
And if you really take a look at that, it's public enemy number one.
It is. It's a huge health issue in this country, if not the world right now. I mean, the statistics are alarming. So we are going to take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about some of the substance abuse problems that are coming through the South Coast Counseling right now, okay?
Okay.
All right.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at 3 campuses, Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology for sponsoring Psych One-on-One. I'm back with Dr. Tarik Grace, and we are talking about drug and alcohol addiction. I want to bring up something that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention site had listed about the poisoning deaths from heroin use, because the use is increasing in this country because it stemmed from people getting injured and then getting onto pain pills, and then the availability, they're having problems with it, and then they're hooked on it. It's that opioid effect, correct?
Correct.
Yes. And then they get switched over to heroin because it's cheaper and it's easier to obtain somehow. And it's just incredible how many clients we have been seeing who have heroin and or methamphetamine addictions. And it's very scary because this could definitely cause death, period. Anyways, from 2000 through 2013, the age-adjusted rate for drug poisoning deaths involving heroin nearly quadrupled from 0.7 deaths per 100,000 in 2000 to 2.7 deaths per 100,000 in 2013. Most of the increase occurred after 2010. The number of drug poisoning deaths involving heroin is nearly 4 times higher for men than women in 2013. In 2000, non-Hispanic black persons aged 45 to 64 had the highest rate for drug poisoning deaths involving heroin. In 2013, non-Hispanic white persons aged 18 to 44 had the highest rate. So this is scary. Can you make a comment on that, Dr. Grace?
Well, I'll agree that it's terrifying. I'll start by saying that when I entered the field of addiction treatment, I did not realize that what I was really going to be battling is heroin addiction. I thought, perhaps from my own experience and what I had seen going through treatments myself, that it was going to be a variety of different drugs, cocaine and methamphetamines and alcohol and opiates. In fact, heroin wasn't really something that was used very much. It was used, had a peak incidence of use right after the Vietnam War, and then kind of went out of fashion, and cocaine took over, and then there's more alcohol problems. And maybe 20 years ago or so, OxyContin, I can't quote the exact date, but OxyContin was released in the market as treated as a new pain relief. And kids started finding out that if they took some of grandma's OxyContin and brought it to school and shared it with their friends, that life was a party, for lack of a better term. Take that and compound that, multiply that by many, 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 many years of use, and now you have a population of people, and this is partly from over-prescribing and partly from just the ease of use and the accessibility and it seems harmless. It's a pill. It's prescribed by the doctor. It comes with directions. And it also became very expensive. And so what happened was OxyContin and those other synthetic opiates became more and more difficult to obtain. And then the DEA smartened up and the regulations on it got a lot stricter and a lot less prescribed. And so you had this population of people now who were addicted to opiates but couldn't really find their, at least their perceived drug of choice. Take that at the same time, these cartels, which seem like they have Harvard MBAs as far as their ability to see and spot trends and make adjustments, they started to increase production of heroin. And heroin was a dirty word. It was a dirty drug. It was a scary word because you saw and immediately, like I think most people view, is they see a dirty syringe stuck in some cotton, pulled up this dirty looking water into a syringe and being used with a needle. And that terrifies most people, sticking a needle in their arm. Well, that's not the heroin of today. The heroin of today is heroin that is smoked, heroin that is snorted, heroin that is done, I laugh when I say this, but heroin that is done like a gentleman, mm-hmm. almost sophisticated. It's still heroin.
Right.
And what's happened is the cartels have made a much purer product and a much cheaper product because of such an increase in supply. The deaths have gone up dramatically. These purer products, before they weren't pure enough, they needed to be slammed or intravenously injected in order to experience the euphoria and high that the drug user was looking for. Now they don't. They can be smoked or snorted. But if you happen to shoot them, overdoses are incredibly common. And you also have a much younger population of people experimenting. I can't fathom, honestly, what it would be like if I was 14 or 15 years old and got a hold of something like this. I know that 14 and 15-year-olds, when they get a hold of a beer, sometimes they go a little crazy with it and drink the whole thing and they throw up and they have the worst experience of their life and they come back. But they can't do that with heroin. That kills people. Mm-hmm. Overdoses absolutely are very real and incredibly deadly. I saw off that article you're reading, there's a 45% increase in deaths in 2 years from heroin.
Yeah, and then the rate of use also doubled. I was doing a project for one of my substance abuse classes for my master's program. And it was about the increase in drug usage. I mean, some of the drugs had actually started decreasing, which was good to see. But the heroin use had doubled within 2 years' time. It was like to about 250,000 users to about 500,000 users. And of course, I mean, that's the reported cases. How many unreported cases are there out there? And it's just, and it's infiltrating places that you would never expect, like small towns.
I was reading an internet blurb. So I don't know if everything you read on the internet, of course, is not accurate, but an internet blurb this morning was talking about the New Hampshire primaries and what's going on in New Hampshire and what New Hampshireonians, for like, I guess that's how you say, people from New Hampshire, what they've believed to be their number one concern was. And it wasn't the economy, public affairs, foreign policy. It was heroin. Heroin. I was blown away that it has reached that level of attention, and it, as it should, because it's killing people.
Yeah, it is. I had also read that Vermont is like the number one state for addiction. Vermont, the tiny, tiny state, you know, and it just blows me away that why is this happening? You know, is there's, you know, I would imagine a multitude of reasons, but what do you think some of the, maybe the top three reasons are that this is increasing?
Well, like I said before, number one is access. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you've introduced what was seemingly a benign or semi-benign substance, which was opiates in pill form. Mm-hmm. And those have been introduced, you know, 20 years ago, and that supply kind of dried up. It didn't totally dry up. Of course, it's still prescribed, but it's not as freely prescribed as it was. And there's a lot more attention from law enforcement, et cetera, over that. And so you have this increased demand, and it's combined with now an increased supply. I mean, it used to be that, and I'm no expert in this, what I'm about to say, but cartels, their primary source of income was cocaine. And I believe that that's completely done a 180-degree turn, and it's now heroin. So they've marked this, or matched this increase in demand with a massive increase in supply. Believe it or not, I've heard, and I believe this, that heroin is more accessible to a 14-year-old than alcohol. Mm. Meaning he's going to have a harder time finding somebody at the street corner that's going to walk into a 7-Eleven and buy him a six-pack, but he can walk right next to the next locker and find his friend that'll give him a bag of heroin for $10. $10. Can't get a bottle of wine for $10.
Not a good one.
Correct.
I know, that's horrible. What's another reason you think that this is happening? I mean, like a societal reason. Is it boredom? Is it lack of hope? You know, because I don't know. I think that so much has changed since 2008, since the economy has been seesawing.
Well, that's you know, the different social pressures that surround addiction. I don't know if I can comment on that with any real authority, because I believe that, you know, addiction has been present since man first started squashing grapes, perhaps even longer than that. So it takes whatever social pressures there are, but now it's really that influx of supply. I do believe that in general, why we see such a higher rate of addiction in this country than in others, it stems from a lot of issues. And I can't speak with real authority on this. This would be something that would be more for a sociologist to comment on. But I believe it has to do with lack of family connection. I believe that it has to do with a lack of direction in that regard. I know that you typically see families that are closer together that have a lot of interaction. You see less drug use. It's more with families that have less involvement with their children. Again, I'm not an expert in that area, but I can see that as the world is becoming a bigger place, it's becoming a more isolated place as well, where people can kind of get to themselves.
And I think it's all, it also has to do too with the technological advancements. And there's so many people that are locked into their computers and their smartphones. And, you know, that's another way to disconnect almost and isolate. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the driving forces, I think, in addiction, is I feel lonely and I feel alone and I don't have anybody that I really love and care about, or they've been abused or abandoned or both as children. I've had so many clients that has been the case. It started from way back and they don't even understand it until you start talking to them about their past, because a lot of times they're in denial or they've had so many things happen to them, they just forget. And the memory system's like offline, and then you add drugs and or alcohol to that whole memory system, and it numbs it out. It changes pathways.
It's crazy to think how addiction really starts. I mean, most if you ask just about any recovered alcoholic or drug addict what got them started, most of them will say, I started because I liked the way it felt, mm-hmm. period.
Or tasted, or, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that liking the way it felt lasted for a period of time. In fact, most people got exactly what they wanted out of drugs and alcohol for a period of time until there started to come a level of pain with it. And that pain can become so dramatic that we'll pay that price. And most addicts, it's been my experience, and I'll go back to kind of tie this in a minute, we'll continue to use drugs and alcohol until the pain of using becomes greater than the perceived pain of getting sober. And that's a sad fact. Mm-hmm. I really wish it was different. And what that really boils down to, what that means, is in order to recover, in order to be even willing to recover, you have to be in a place of unbearable pain. And as a treatment provider, it's one of the most difficult things to watch. I've become a little bit, I don't want to ever use the word calloused, but I actually look forward to seeing people in that place of desperation, because I know absolutely that's when I have the most hope for them. You brought up social media and phones and internet. And I can tell you, as a treatment provider, that plays in a very interesting dynamic into treating people with addiction. Because you're right, you can absolutely isolate and completely disconnect and hide and lose the ability to connect with other people, which I feel is one of the main taproots in recovery, is establishing healthy, normal, for lack of a better term, normal connections with people. And as most addicts started using, again, because they liked the effects. But why did they like the effects? It made them feel more connected. So I can tell you that most people start drinking because it's a social lubricant, for lack of a better term. It allows them to mold a little bit better into the whatever group they're in at the particular time, feel more comfortable, talk a little bit easier, etc. And that very purpose that you used drugs or alcohol for very quickly does a 180-degree turn on you, and now it isolates you. It's actually severing your connections. And getting back and finding that connection again is crucial. And cell phones and computer and internet and all these things that we use to numb out really stand in the way of treating people effectively.
Exactly. That's why, and that can turn into another addiction too, right?
Yes.
I know. When we come back, let's talk about building some hope for recovery and what are some elements that really make recovery realistic.
Okay, sounds good.
Are you searching for answers and insight to life issues? Is the behavior of family or friends questionable or concerning? Find tips and possible solutions from the convenience of your own PC, cell phone, or tablet at therapycable.com. Therapy Cable has the most comprehensive library of contemporary therapy videos online. Help may be as easy as a few clicks away. Therapy Cable offers comprehensive therapy videos ranging from addiction to self-care and contact information for qualified providers. Find the answers to your life challenges at therapycable.com. Welcome back to Psych One-on-One with Julianne Good and Dr. Tara Grace. We are finishing up talking about drug and alcohol addiction, and we want to give you some words of hope for recovering. We are both recovered addicts, and we're here to tell you that you can do it also, or get your family or friends into treatment. It gets to the point where they're just hitting a wall. It's so important you can be saving their lives or saving your life. So, Dr. Grace, can you give us a little bit of insight about what you're doing at South Coast Counseling and Elite Care?
Absolutely. This is the fun part. Historically, the success rates for people trying to recover from alcohol and drug addiction has been dismal. It's been 5% at best, even the best centers. It's only been in the last few years that they've taken a different approach to treating addiction. And addiction was previously treated, well, there's many different modalities that was treated in the past. Some was aversion therapy, where you would actually look at a drug and you'd be given a noxious stimulant, and then you would have this horrible reaction to it. Anabuse is another example of that.
You explain what anabuse is?
Anabuse, it's an acetaldehyde blocker. So alcohol, you drink alcohol, it forms acetaldehyde, and then from acetaldehyde it goes to carbon dioxide and water. Acetaldehyde is horrifically toxic. So the enzyme acetaldehyde dehydrogenase is blocked by anabuse. So what happens is that acetaldehyde levels elevate. It's extremely toxic, and the person who drinks develops this high level of acetaldehyde and he feels incredibly sick almost instantly. Now, some alcoholics will drink right through that, believe it or not, but that's one form of aversion therapy. Nowadays, you know, what we're doing at Elite Care and South Coast Counseling is we're combining science with social modeling. The treatment of the past was primarily social modeling. And then treatment in the more recent past was social modeling with some clinical skill building. And now we're taking it to another level where we're using some, you know, hard science behind it. We're addressing the underlying issues of depression and anxiety and trauma. And we're addressing them not only through traditional psychological treatment modalities, but also through appropriate medications, hormonal manipulation or rebalancing, proper exercise and nutrition, as well as social modeling. One of the most incredible things I think that's come out with addiction, especially for heroin addiction, is that there's now available commercially a naltrexone implant. And what that is it's naltrexone is an opiate blocker. It blocks the effects of opiates, heroin being the opiate of choice, I suppose we're talking about. And in the past, the only option for taking naltrexone was taking it orally and having it last for 36-hour half-life. Well, they now can actually implant a marble-sized pellet underneath the skin in the soft tissue where the effect will be up to a year. And that person that has that will not be able to get affected by opiates for up to a year. So you combine that. That alone by itself is something, but that combined with the psychological treatment modalities, the psychiatric treatment modalities, and the social modeling, as well as the medical medication management, starts to really give some significant promise. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that we're starting to see outcomes upwards of 40% success rates, which is unheard of in the past. Mm-hmm. So, and in most cases, in almost all cases, we see it at the very least, we see harm reduction, which means that if they don't get and stay sober, they've had a period of sobriety, which they look back at as probably the best time they've had in the last 10 or 15 years, and they aren't out for very long before they come back. And it might take a few skips before that happens, and they achieve long-lasting, durable sobriety. But each time they come back, we arm them with more.
Exactly. And I think they're a little more serious, too, because they know it's like, you know, a lot of times they will have the thought when they are leaving, especially at about the 30-day point. It's like, I've got this. I can go out. I can go back and I can stay sober. I don't have to worry. I can be successful. They almost get too amped up, go back, and they relapse. Or it's just, you know, like you said, they get the hiccups. It's just, you know, it's a little bumpy. And hopefully, if that happens, they get back on the road. They call up their support system. A lot of times, and I know they, you guys are working with 12-step programs, mm-hmm. AA, NA, and, you know, getting them to incorporate that into their daily lives, setting up sponsors so that they've got the additional social support along with getting the support in the household and in the office. So it just, you know, it adds to the success rate of, and as you said, connecting back up to humans and building those levels of trust again and building up that self-esteem that may have been knocked down or maybe even not even built up in the first place.
The beautiful and wonderful thing about alcoholism and drug addiction is that recovery is possible for 100% of people who do 100% of the work mm-hmm. and accept 100% of the solution. There isn't another disease out there that can make that claim. And I think that it's now starting to see that people are starting to realize that recovery from addiction, it's not, there's no surgical treatment to this. I mean, we can do certain modalities that are quick, that have lasting effects, such as implants, et cetera. But this is a complete lifestyle change as well. And, I don't do much different in my life today than I did when I was in treatment. I still do all the things that I learned there. And it's allowed me to become very free and live a very happy, productive life and help other people. So if we're back to giving people hope, the hope is that, I was a beat up, hopeless addict who, by the eyes of society, threw their life away. And I was one step away from being thrown in a cage and throw the keys away. And today, several years later, it's a completely different story, and here to help other people. So if I can do it, so can anybody else.
Exactly. And the same with me. And that's what I tell a lot of my clients. If I can do it, you can do it too. You know, and I'm here as a testimony that, I've been through my bumps, and I've been through many, many challenges, which I sometimes share little pieces of. But it's just like, because a lot of times people come in and are like, you can't fix me. I'm broken. And we're here to say, yes, you can. There is a survivor inside of you that has kept you going this far, this long. You deserve to be here. You have a purpose for being here. And I think that's so important to tell people you do have a purpose for being here, and you just need to see what that is. And sometimes that takes time and experience and reconnecting with people and reconnecting with yourself, getting to know who you truly are. And getting the old tapes out of your head, erasing those. If people want to contact you, how can they do so?
Probably the best way to contact me is email. I'll spell it out. TAREKG. So TarekG at southcoastcounseling.com or TarekG at elitecaretreatment.com. Either way.
Okay. And can you give us just a quick wrap up here of about 30 seconds? And what do you foresee happening in treatment overall?
Well, what I think most importantly is reaching out to people and letting them know that treatment is possible. Drug addiction is a disease which preys upon hope and destroys hope in people. And that's when it wins. And being able to actually give hope back is the number one way that we actually are going to be defeating addiction, one person at a time. I'm happy to be a part of this. I feel honored to be in this profession and helping people recover from addiction. It's definitely a calling of mine. As far as the summary goes, the treatment from drug and alcohol addiction has come a long way. They were using, 100 years ago, they didn't know what to do. They were using heroin to treat alcoholism and such and so forth. And we've come to the place now where we attack addiction on multiple prongs. And if appropriately treated, it is a disease of which remission can be absolutely attained.
I agree. Thank you so much, Dr. Grace.
Thank you.
And if you would like to contact me, my email is jgoode8@verizon.net. My office number is 562-209-1837. And office is in Santa Ana, California. We are just going to be moving in a couple of weeks to a much larger, beautiful space. Please reach out and get some help or help somebody else if you know that they're suffering. This is Julianne Good. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Happy holidays.